The Guardian.
Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
In this week's podcast, we'll be talking to the novelist Dan Rhodes about A Creepy Grey Man. Guardian Children's book supremo Julia Eccleshare explains why vampires have taken over the Italian city of Bologna. But we begin this week's programme with Philip Pullman's controversial rewrite of the life of Jesus. Or should that be Christ? In this excerpt from the audiobook version read by Philip Pullman himself, Joseph is troubled by his young wife's unexpected pregnancy and wonders how to make an honest woman of her.
Not long afterwards there came a decree from the Roman emperor saying that everyone should go to their ancestral town in order to be counted in a great census. Joseph lived in Nazareth in Galilee, but his family had come from Bethlehem in Judea, some days' journey to the south. He thought to himself, "How shall I have them record Mary's name? I can list my sons, but what shall I do with her? Shall I call her my wife? I'd be ashamed. Should I call her my daughter? But people know she's not my daughter, and besides, it's obvious that she's expecting a child. What can I do?" In the end, he set off, with Mary riding a donkey behind him. The child was due to be born any day, and still Joseph did not know what he was going to say about his wife. When they had nearly reached Bethlehem, he turned around to see how she was, and saw her looking sad. "Perhaps she's in pain," he thought. A little later he turned around again, and this time saw her laughing. "What is it?" he said. "A moment ago you were looking sad, and now you're laughing." "I saw two men," she said, "and one of them was weeping and crying, and the other was laughing and rejoicing." There was no one in sight. He thought, "How can this be?" But he said no more, and soon they came to the town. Every inn was full, and Mary was crying and trembling, for the child was about to be born. "There's no room," said the last innkeeper they asked, "but you can sleep in the stable. The beasts will keep you warm." Joseph spread their bedding on the straw and made Mary comfortable and ran to find a midwife. When he came back, the child was already born, but the midwife said, "There's another to come. She's having twins."
Oh dear, whatever will happen next? The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ was commissioned by the publisher Canongate as part of their rewritings of great myths. As you might have heard, there have already been some accusations of blasphemy, and Philip Pullman was flanked by security guards at a recent publicity event in his home city of Oxford. But surprisingly, Pullman has said that the book was inspired by no less a figure than the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who asked him 6 years ago why he'd not put Jesus into his great trilogy, His Dark Materials. And indeed, in this week's Easter edition of the Guardian Saturday Review, Rowan Williams reviews the book for us. With me here in the studio to discuss all this, a religious affairs correspondent of The Guardian, Riazat Butt, and religion editor of The Times literary supplement, Rupert Short, who is also the Archbishop's biographer. Welcome both. Riazat, this has been quite controversial already. Can you just fill us in a little bit on the reaction to it so far?
Well, I mean, Philip Pullman has made no secret of his antipathy towards religion and organised religion, and I suppose this book is the latest instalment in that particular story. And whenever you do have a reimagining of Christ, which this basically is, people do get offended. They say that you shouldn't treat Jesus and his story and his life with disrespect. And I think the publication as well around the time of Easter is causing some people to have concern, and they say that, you know, the figure of Jesus and his story is subject to unnecessary criticism and derision, and that other religious figures wouldn't be treated in the same way.
Do you think that's right? I mean, if this was a retelling of the Quran, there would be much more trouble about
it. Oh, yeah, you'd have riots in the street. I mean, the latest example we had was when the publisher, or the would-be publisher of The Jewel of the Medina, which was a novel about one of the prophet's wives, there were fictitious elements in it, and one of them was a sex scene. And even before the book had been published, the rumours of what the book contained had gone around the blogosphere, and, you know, the author went into hiding, she received death threats, and the publisher's house in London was firebombed, and three people were convicted. So it's a continuation of what happened with the Satanic Verses 20 years ago, but on a much smaller scale. So I think if this involved a figure from Islamic traditions, you would see much more visible protests. But I think where people are protesting now will be on the letters pages of newspapers and on blogs such as The Guardian.
Rupert, could you explain what Pullman does in the book?
Yes, it's a kind of riff on the story of the Gospels. As we've just heard in the extract read out, Mary gives birth not to one son, but to two, and they're twins, Jesus and Christ. Jesus is an earthy, generous visionary, radical enough to create panic in conventional religious and political authority. And Christ is the nickname given for the weaker, self-righteous, fearful brother who shadows Jesus, trying to persuade him to accept a destiny that he refuses. In due course, Christ is approached by a rather sinister-seeming figure, the stranger, who appears to be an envoy from God, and asks him to record all of Jesus's doings. The process of monitoring then shades into a kind of deception, where at the end of the story, Jesus is crucified according to the gospel narrative, and he is replaced by Christ in the resurrection appearances. And there you have the source of the Christian Gospels and of the church, that's to say, lying in a kind of conjuring trick, a deception which will persuade generations of gullible believers thereafter to accept the narrative that we have in the Bible.
What is so controversial about it? I mean, he's changed the story in some crucial respects, hasn't he? Obviously, there are the twins. Then he doesn't have Judas. He's had to write Judas out of the story, hasn't he?
Well, I think as the Archbishop of Canterbury has suggested in his review for The Guardian, it's very reasonable to see the figure of Christ, quote-unquote, in this story as Judas himself. They're controversial because Pullman's ideas themselves are rather questionable. I think one is that religion is all about control. Secondly, that the church's record down the centuries has been uniformly awful. And thirdly, his argument is premised on some historical theories about the origins of the Gospels and what seems to me a rather old-fashioned assumption that you can disentangle a historical core from a theological carapace in the narrative.
Riazat, are you surprised that the head of the church, of our church, the church of the tradition which this is in a way rewriting, should engage on in the literary pages of a newspaper with it?
No, actually. It's exactly what I would expect him to do. He likes reading books. He likes writing about reading books. I think whatever his critics may say about his sort of theological or ideological positions, that he is very well respected as an academic and intellectual. And a lot of his detractors will say that he is better as an academic and an intellectual than he is an Archbishop of Canterbury. I think he likes grappling with complex ideas and taking them apart and putting them back together again. I mean, he's a very interesting man. He likes Dostoevsky and he likes the Muppet Christmas Carol. I mean, he has a very broad range of interests and he's quite a warm and earthy person. And of course, the other thing is that the review itself is a minor masterpiece.
Ah, there's praise indeed. Rupert, I'm intrigued by this picture of Pullman and the Archbishop sitting down to an event and the Archbishop seeding this story in the mind of Pullman.
I really don't think that he's got any source for worry from the theories of Philip Pullman.
Were you confusing Philip Pullman with Richard Dawkins? Was that a slip of the tongue?
They're very much on the same page, I suppose, aren't they, and in lots of ways. He probably feels that Philip Pullman is easier to engage with and that narrative provides a way of hoofing around these ideas.
Well, we'll leave it with part of the comment thread in response to one of the stories we ran on the internet this week, which is from somebody called What a Palaver, who says, "If you want to know about the historical Jesus, read Quarantine by Jim Crace. If you want an antidote to religious rants, read Dawkins or Hitchens. If you want something with a bit of theological wibbling, I don't know quite what that word means, but it sounds good, read Karen Armstrong or even dear old Terry Eagleton. If your preferred choice is bigoted, ludicrous crap, then St. Paul is your man." Typical open-minded Guardian reader there. Thanks to Rupert Short and Riazat Butt. I interviewed our next guest, Dan Rhodes, at the Hay Literary Festival, and he was practically lynched for a different sort of blasphemy, the gratuitous killing of a dog at the end of his novel Timely and Vieta Come Home. Dan Rhodes' latest novel, Little Hands Clapping, has just won the prestigious E.M. Forster Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. It's the story of an unusual museum in a narrow street in an unidentified German city. The main character is the museum's sole attendant, a creepy old man who is described mainly in terms of his tongue and his fingers. They're all long and thin and grey. Here's Dan Rhodes reading from his novel.
The old man rose at 6. In bare feet, and still in his nightshirt and nightcap, he began his weekly rounds, making sure there was nothing that would surprise the museum's proprietor and her husband on their visit. Following the suggested route, he started in room 1, through the ages, where he checked the exhibits for damage. The sculpture of Antony and Cleopatra was fine, and so were the portraits of Heinrich von Kleist and Vincent van Gogh, and the holographic representation of the self-immolation of Tik Kwang Duk. Room 11 was the largest of the exhibition spaces. It began with 2 photographs of Marilyn Monroe. In the first, she was subduing her billowing skirt in a promotional still for the 7-year itch, and in the second, she was lying in the morgue, her beauty gone so completely that it was as if it had only ever been a mirage or a trick. Then came a photograph of Kurt Cobain's right leg, a charcoal drawing of Ernest Hemingway, a knitted doll of the singing nun, a scale model of the Hollywood sign complete with a 4-inch peg entwhistle plummeting from the top of the letter H, and a doll's house with the walls cut away to reveal Sylvia Plath with her head in a gas oven, the children asleep in the next room. Next, there was an exceptionally lifelike waxwork of Yukio Mishima in his final moments, his face impassive, as he held a sword in his hand, his guts spilling from a slit across his belly. This was the museum's most photographed exhibit, with tourists taking turns to stand beside it with their thumbs aloft, as if this was Madame Tussauds and he was Indiana Jones or Enrique Iglesias. Beside Mishima was an embedded television screen. The old man pushed a button, and a minute-long silent film began, showing a recreation of Virginia Woolf's fateful wade into the River Ouse, her pockets filled with stones. This side of the room finished with a cardboard cutout of a leather-trousered Michael Hutchence, and as the old man passed it, he wasn't surprised to see that on the singer's hand, the one holding the microphone, somebody had written the words, "Wanking accident."
Dan Rhodes reading a typically gothic extract from Little Hands Clapping. You can hear a longer version of that on the book's podcast site. He spoke to our reporter, Lindsay Irving, who began by asking him why he took up writing.
I get asked a lot why I wanted to become a writer, and I usually just give some fairly insubstantial cop-out of an answer. I just sort of mumble and change the subject. But I was coming to this interview on the train today, reading Mojo magazine, and it just really struck me, sort of, why I decided to go into writing. I was reading about the Syd Barrett album, The Madcap Laughs, and they're showing the covers, and it's Syd Barrett just looking incredibly cool in an empty room with painted floorboards. That's the front cover. And on the back cover, it's the same scene, but writhing on a stool behind him, there's this naked woman. And I thought, that's what I want my life to be like. And I realised at that point that wasn't going to happen if I went and worked for the pensions company, which is what my school wanted all the boys to do. So I realised at that point that I had to go into showbiz, and I'm pretty unmusical. All my attempts at making music have failed horribly. And so I thought I'd have a go at being a writer, really. I thought that would be my passport to stripy floorboards and naked women on stools.
And has the strategy worked? Do you have a writhing naked woman on a painted floored house?
It hasn't worked with the floorboards so far, but I did meet my wife while I was on a book tour in San Francisco. So I think I do have a much more glamorous wife than I would have done if I'd gone to work for NPI. So partial success, yeah. Only the floorboards to go.
I'm now sort of curious to know where the idea of a suicide museum came from.
I've spent a lot of my time walking around very small and unusual museums, and they usually tend to be overseen by staring, cadaverous old men. And you've got to wonder what goes through these men's minds as they stand there, stock still, with just their eyes following you around the room. And I think that's where the idea for this character came from. And I also wanted him to be thoroughly nasty. It's quite trendy to have characters who are, you know, fully rounded, yin and yang, but I really wanted to just base him on a Hammer House of Horror kind of vampire, really. Just a really creepy old dude walking around an empty, virtually empty house.
And the creepiness of the museum's contents seems to maybe be sort of sidling up to something more generalised in our culture about the fascination with celebrities who kill themselves.
Yeah, well, normally I pride myself on not putting any pop cultural references at all in my books, but that passage I just read is absolutely rammed with them. So that's really the only point in the book where that happens,
right,
where
okay.
Where celebrities are used to draw people in and supposedly inspire people.
Have you become more serious as you've gone on?
I think I've become a bit more boring as I've gone on, because when I started out, I was sort of rampaging mid-20-something, and now I'm married with a kid in my 30s, and in the old days I'd always be out looking for adventure and finding it and disgracing myself along the way, and then my personal disgrace would somehow feed its way into my fiction. But I'm a lot more cautious these days and a lot more grown up, and I'm really pleased that Little Hands Clapping has actually turned out to be really quite an immature book. There are lots of knob gags, lots of anus gags, and I don't think I've grown up quite yet, which I'm very pleased about.
Do you have models for the sort of surreal comedy that you're producing here? Were there particular writers that inspired you?
Yeah, I think with this book I was reading a lot of suspense fiction, and I wanted it to be action-driven. So even though it starts out quite creepy and a little bit, I don't know, I suppose it seems like a psychological horror story maybe at first, but by the end it's an action-driven romp. And I really set out to write a solid slab of entertainment, and I was reading a lot of suspense fiction from the olden days, people like Cornell Woolrich, and a load of more recent police fiction like the Rebus books and things like that, and I thought, I want a bit of that, I want a good bit of page-turning action.
The other thing I'm curious about is how the experience of being a Granter Young Novelist, Best of Young British Novelists, has been for you, because that's, some people have found that a bit of a burden, but how has it been for you?
Yeah, I think being on the Granter list has probably closed more doors than it's opened.
Really?
I think so, because I think, well, with the new one I'm setting out, well, and with all my books really, I'm setting out to just really write a solid slab of entertainment, but I think I'm bracketed alongside some, you know, pretty plodding and dreary people like Ian McEwan, who's, you know, I read On Chesil Beach and I just thought, I don't want to be associated with that. Don't put me in that bracket. So I think it's sort of a very literary and quite snobby thing, and that's not really where my writing's coming from, I don't think.
Dan Rhodes talking to Lindsay Irving. Little Hands Clapping is published by Canongate. If Dan Rhodes' central character is creepy, he's nothing on the characters that have dominated teen fiction for the last few years. Vampires. Only this week, Stephanie Meyer's Twilight novella, The Short Second Life of Bree Tanner, reached number one in Amazon.co.uk books chart less than 24 hours after the title became available for pre-order. It's not actually published until June. There were plenty more bloodsuckers at large at the Bologna Children's Book Fair, as our children's books editor, Julia Eccleshare, found out. She joins us now with all the hot news. Welcome, Julia.
Hello.
Now, tell us, isn't it about time the craze for vampires finished?
Well, interestingly, the publishers still think they've got, I'm not sure this is quite the right word, but they've got legs. They still think they can publish them. And interestingly, in fact, a lot of them find that they had vampire series on their backlist because people have tried vampires before. Nothing is ever completely new. And they just weren't selling. But, of course, now, in the wake of Twilight, people are finding they've got very good product. They're rejacketing it in black and red or black and white and silver. L.J. Smith's Vampire Diaries, for example, are not new publications, but Hodder have brought them out looking very fresh and very Stephanie Meyer-ish. So they think there's still quite a lot of life in vampires. Interestingly, they think they're very American. They think they have to be kind of part of the mystique of them is that they are not set in the UK. They have that kind of American slight gloss and glamour. But it's also interesting because they're not really vampires in the sense of nasty blood-sucking things. Well, they are, but they're really romances.
Yeah, they're very sexy.
They're very sexy.
Very
There's
surprised.
Lots of sort of black lace and kind of wispiness and yearning. Lots and lots of yearning. I mean, my view is that at a time when teens are not able to do any yearning because they can Facebook each other or Skype each other or text each other every second of every day, you need a bit of distance. I mean, if you think in Jane Austen, you couldn't see a character once they'd moved to another county. You couldn't see a person. Now you can see everybody all the time. So you a bit of romance in the way the vampires series is. It's quite nice.
It's also got that thing of teenage girls' desperation both to be different and to be desired, hasn't it? And that came, I have to say, I have actually read Twilight.
Yes, I think you should have read Twilight.
And I found that really fascinating. I could completely understand why they love it so much.
It's absolutely page-turning. It's classic page-turning stuff. You do want to go on finding out what happens next. But, I mean, obviously vampires aren't the only thing that they're interested in. I mean, the publishers are always, and one of the things about the fair is they are always looking for the next big thing. And it's very interesting. You find yourself thinking, you know, E.B. White sit down to write Charlotte's Web thinking this will be the next big thing. I mean, it's not really how books come about, but a fair, you know, generates a certain kind of excitement. And the big thing of the fair, the book of the fair, there's always a book of the fair, was a book called The Emerald Atlas, which is the first in a trilogy, a fantasy trilogy written by a brand new American author who's, you know, only been a TV producer before. And it was variously described to me as it had everything a fantasy should in terms of dragons and magic and all of those things. And obviously, alternatively, it was described as very derivative. And it's absolutely bang in the key children's market. It's 9+. It's not in the vampire territory, really, which is, I think, almost out of children's books. I mean, it is positioned in the children's book market and it's partly why children's books are doing so well. But this
sort
new...
Sort of 16, 17-year-olds, isn't it? Or late
well,
teens.
It's sort of 13, 14-year-olds.
Right,
but
yeah.
I think it's a lot of 20s reading down to the vampires
yes.
rather than reading up necessarily. Whereas The Emerald Atlas, the Book of the Fair, was a real buzzy 9+ title. But the figure being quoted was 300,000 was not even going to be looked at by the agent for a 3-book deal.
Gosh.
And for the UK and Australian rights, that was a lot of money. And
there is still big money being paid.
And the UK publishers were fighting very shy of it. They liked it, but they didn't think that they would necessarily be able to ever pay that amount for it. But it was bought immediately after the fair by HarperCollins. So that will be one of the very heavily promoted books of next year, even if it's not actually a big book.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were a couple of prize announcements, weren't there? This is always the time when the international children's prizes are awarded.
Yes, and it was wonderful for the UK publishers because David Armand, who is a very highly regarded author, really, by everybody. I mean, he's a writer's writer, as well as his books having been adapted, particularly Skellig, obviously, has been adapted for opera. A lot of his books have been filmed for TV. And Skellig is just one of those books that every child in year 6 or year 7 has read. And it was the next big thing when it came. Nobody called it that, but actually, he had a totally original voice, which we you know, anybody who read Skellig would have recognised and comes out in all his writing. So it was very exciting that he should have won the Hans Christian Andersen medal this year because, in fact, looking back through the list, the last time a UK writer won it was in 2002 when Aidan Chambers won it. It's only awarded every other year, but even so, the English writers are not particularly highly represented on it. Mm. We've done better with illustrators.
Now, moving on from books that, from futures, as it were, onto the present, this is obviously a time of year when parents might have a little bit of leisure to read with their children before their children's souls get stolen by vampires. So give us some of the titles that we should be getting into.
Well, I thought it'd be nice to look at the sort of strong 5 to 8s when you've actually become a reader, because that seems to me when children are really made into readers. It's finding a book at that point that you really want to get into, or if somebody reads it aloud to you, that shows you what story can be alike. It's not a new book, it's not a new series, but it's been very well republished, and it ties in with a film, which is always a good way of getting children to it, the Cressida Cole How to Train Your Dragon series, which are an absolutely madcap romp round a kind of sort of Viking world. And they are just very, very funny, and they're incredibly readable. And I think they're just the kind of thing that gets children reading. I also think David Armand, this very successful recent prize winner, his new book called The Boy Who Climbed Into the Moon, with lovely illustrations by Polly Dunbar, is a wonderful fantasy about a boy who doesn't believe that the moon is the moon but thinks it's a hole in the sky and gets a ladder to climb up. And it's full of all David Armand's hallmark magical realism. It's an incredibly interesting, curious story for any child who wants to ask questions and find answers. And then another great romp, and the winner of this year's Waterstone First Book Prize was Katie Davis's The Great Hamster Massacre, and all you really need to know about it is in the title. And that is a standalone book, and that's nice. I mean, I think it's nice to have a story that has a beginning, middle and an end. I'm terribly old-fashioned about that. I don't think you necessarily have to have a book that's going to lead you into several more adventures. There's something very satisfying about a book that you close and you think, yeah, that was great.
Well, I would second you on that. And actually, it's a good time to end this podcast. Thank you very much for coming in, Julia. We'll all be reading along with your recommendations. Thanks also to Rupert Short, Riazat Butt and Dan Rhodes. In this week's Guardian Saturday Review, we will, of course, be carrying that review by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. On Sunday, The Observer asks six well-known novelists what they think of New Labour's time in power. But that's it for now. Until next week, happy Easter. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Corley.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.